I'm here with Penny Wheelwright today. She's a local filmmaker and her company is Starry Productions. And she's in the studio to talk about some of her ongoing projects, as well as a recent film that was featured at the Vancouver Film Festival and is going to be shown on Knowledge Network on April 29th at 10 p.m. And it's called Under Wraps. So we're going to ask a few questions about the history of this film and how it came about.
Hi there. Under Wraps started, it's been about 5 years in the making, actually, from the first concept. It's a film on menstruation, and it was a very difficult film to raise money for. When we first started, Teresa McInnes, who I did the film with, when we first started sending our proposal out for it, we got responses back like, that's far too frank for television broadcast to discuss that subject. And we found that shocking to us, but it also made us mad, and we continued with it, and subsequently got money on other projects, and went ahead and did those, but kept working on this thing. It was always kind of simmering on the back burner, and got to a point where we had enough credibility with the funding agencies and the broadcasters that they said, okay, if you really, you know, that's what you want to do, do it. So that's, and by the time we got to that point, it took us about a year to actually shoot and edit and get everything together.
So not long in the making, the actual production, but I guess the researching took you a while. And getting the getting the funding the major sort of problem, or the...
Getting the funding was the biggest stumbling block, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because there's several issues. We were looking at the sanitary protection industry, who advertise on a lot of the mainstream television broadcasters, and have a lot of money. So, you know, that was difficult for the broadcasters in one sense, the commercial broadcasters. And they were very honest about that, too, you know. As well, just the subject matter alone made people blush when we were pitching it,
right?
You know, which was the whole point of why we were doing it, is to say why is this something in our culture that happens to women, most women, every month, and we still feel very uncomfortable about talking about it.
It's the most basic of all, and it's very strange, but I've encountered the same problem. I remember in just a physiology course, reproductive system was actually left until the very last few days. And it was originally supposed to have, I think, 5 days, and it got cut down to sort of like 2 lectures instead. And yet it's almost glossed over, and it's hard for them to even bring it to this forum of 800 students, yet it's so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the basis of who we are.
Well, and also if you look at how we looked at how our young people are being educated about it, and a lot of the films that are being taught, you know, when you have your big chat in grade six, the films are often made by the product companies, and they advertise their products in the films, and it's very blatant that's my opinion. But so we wanted to do a film that was actually on the subject for adults, for men and women. And we tried to make it as mainstream as we could. And because there was so little out there on it, it was very hard to get it in 57 minutes, which is the length of a 1-hour broadcast.
It's an exceptionally wonderful film, and it raises a lot of interesting points. One of them being, like, why were the sanitary product companies so opposed to having their advertisements or their names used in the film? They didn't want you to use any of their commercials. They didn't want you to clip them in.
Well, it was more the ads. It wasn't so much that they didn't want us to. We made a conscious decision not to ourselves. I didn't approach a lot of the companies to actually do that. We chose not to do that because we thought that's what everyone knows about it. That's the image that everyone knows. And so we decided to use cartoons and humor, because that's often another way that it's it's looked at is through humor. Menstruation has always got a joke behind it, you know. Same with PMS, you know. It's like the same thing. And we looked at what happened since 1970 with the image of menstruation and how, you know, since that time you had toxic shock and PMS, which are two sort of diseases that have come up around it. And why was that, and what was the phenomena around that? So that was a very interesting process to meet with the people. We met with the top researchers who are working in toxic shock. We met with victims of toxic shock. We met with artists who are trying to get the image of menstruation out. We had a wonderful week with Judy Chicago, who did the menstruation bathroom in the 1970s, which was part of Woman House.
That was interesting. Like, that was done in the 1970s and seeming so progressive and really out there. And and now it's kind of like we've gone back, this more conservative aspect. You don't see exhibits like what she did.
Well, and when we were at this was in Los Angeles, when we were at the museum, that there was a warning, you know, about bringing young students in to see the exhibit.
Why? Really?
Just the sensitive nature of the subject matter. You know, children. So I think there's a lot of fear around it. So there's a lot of fear around the fact that we bleed.
There is, because, you know, women almost have that, when their children are very young, they're willing to sort of take them into the bathroom with them. But once they reach a certain age, it's like cover up. My child can't see even that, you know, there's anything going on beneath my clothes. Mm-hmm. And I guess that extends to this whole thing about so few children are really aware of, I guess, the life. What's going on?
Well, I think that it depends on, it comes back to the family. One of the things we did in our research is we went to a place called the Menstrual Health Foundation. And the woman who runs that actually does workshops with mothers and daughters. And the mothers talk about what it was like for their first menstruation together and kind of debrief on that. And the silence around it was the biggest thing for them, is that a lot of them had, you know, were welcomed into this new experience in their life or this new stage of their life with absolute silence or shame, you know. And so what they were trying to do is they were trying to make it better for their daughters, and they were trying to think of how could they do that. And they came up with a little ritual that they do where they actually crown the girls in a blessing ceremony and give them flowers and make them feel special and say, this is, you know, this is a great thing. But I think that they had, you know, when I actually went to the ceremony, the girls were kind of going, oh, well, whatever, you know, and the mothers were bawling because it was really about a loss of what they had had. You know, they had been shut out and of that experience for themselves. So it was a very special moment for them. I don't know how much it was for the young women, you know, which was interesting.
No, it's true, I guess. Do you find that it's an interesting group that got together and is doing ceremonies for young women who are on the verge, I guess, of becoming women? Mm-hmm. Becoming women. But is that more of an isolated case, or do you see groups like that actually...
Well, in the educational system, I think it's fairly unique. But there's a lot of cultures that, you know, we didn't even get into any of that in the film. There's a lot of cultures that do have very celebratory, positive experiences and ceremonies for their children.
Recreating them now.
Yeah. When I grew up, it was, you know, the grade 6 teacher was my first introduction, and she was about 60. And she, you know, we had this school nurse came in, and she had a pear, which she turned upside down, and then she had two plastic straws out of it with two plastic grapes on either ends. And she said, this is your ovaries, this is your fallopian tubes, and this is your womb. And I just sat there and thought, I have fruit inside me, you know. I don't think this is right, you know, but... And then I was embarrassed because I was stood up in front of the class because my breasts were developing, I guess, more than most girls. They had assumed I already had my period. So I was used as an example to put the belt on, which we were did in those days, those plastic belts. And it was left quite an impression on me, but I really didn't understand what it was really about. And then when I got my period, I wasn't sure if it was it. And my sister said there was no way because she hadn't had hers. And
your sister was older than you?
She was a year and a half older than me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was, it wasn't actually my period. I just had a bit of discharge, which most young women actually have. That's part of the thing that we're not told about that either. You just have spotting when you're first starting. And then when I got my period, I didn't tell anyone. So that's kind of, I think that's very common for a lot of women.
It still is today.
I think so. Well, I don't know, I think so. Talking with a lot of women, certainly women of, I'm like 33 now, women my age and older, with the women that we met and spoke with. But then, you know, it's not a subject that, like there's a lot of women say, well, I don't care about my period. I mean, it's just not a big deal for me. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to celebrate it. I don't want to, it's just a pain in the ass, personally. And that's a valid point of view as well. Like, we're not trying to say in the film that, you know, this is something that you should celebrate or this is something you should acknowledge. Or personally, as a woman, and we were just looking at the lack of discussion around it at all in our culture. And what are the effects of that silence? What are the effects of that? The effects of that are, you know, you've got a lot of issues that are just not addressed, like our education of our young women and boys too. I mean, boys, I went into a grade 9 class and did a session and talked to the kids, and, you know, one little boy put up his hand, well, not little, grade 9, and said, what's the difference between a condom and a tampon? And what is a tampon? And, you know, and they told me that in their year they had been both, you know, they'd still been separated out. And the teacher would ask them to put notes in a little bag, and then he would pick out the questions he felt comfortable speaking about, basically. Because if your teacher feels uncomfortable about the subject, then it's hard too, you know. You know, it's like all the whatever his baggage is, you know. And then I did a little test, where a little quiz thing that I put out on the table, and I asked them questions about menstruation, how they felt about it. And most of the answers I got back from the grade 9 girls when I went home and read them were, I feel fat, I feel ugly, I feel bitchy, I feel like I want to go under a rock and die when I get my period. And, you know, the girls were also saying, you know, if they get angry at the lockers or whatever, the boys will say, you're just PMS. So all those kind of attitudes, I think, filter down. And I actually cried when I read those.
Yeah, it's an extremely, I think, critical time for development, and probably when our young women's self-esteem can really fluctuate up and down. And this lack of education, perhaps, it keeps them silent and sort of victimizing themselves, whereas a lot of the information that we should pass on down to them could help them out in their passageway. Whether it be how to sort of maybe best alleviate some of the symptoms. Some women suffer enormously during their period.
Incredible pain.
Yeah. The changes of young girls with diabetes have a really hard time because of the change into puberty. The levels of hormones fluctuate quite up and down, and this can cause it's very hard to get their insulin levels under control. And they might find getting high sugar and low sugar and not really being able to maintain control and gaining weight, losing weight, you know, massive mood swings. There's a whole bunch of things going on, and yet we don't open it up for discussion and really doing these women a disfavor.
And with toxic shock, too, the group that is most susceptible to it, even though it is a rare disease, is young women. The studies show that, you know, if you're between the ages of, you know, say 12 and 20, that's the most dangerous group, most susceptible.
Is that because of more of like the lack of knowledge about how it can occur, or
no, it's
what?
About an antibody that's in your system, which you develop as you get older. If you're younger, you don't have, it takes a while to develop that antibody. So that's what that's about. Yeah.
Hmm. So how can we best help those young women that are at higher at risk for toxic shock syndrome?
Well, I think just to be aware of
maybe some of the myths around toxic shock syndrome.
Or just to have it brought out and discussed, and look at some of the realities of it. As we're hoping in the film, I mean, it is a rare disease, and that was the biggest thing. You don't want to cause a lot of unnecessary concern.
Mm-hmm.
But the person that we interviewed in the film, Dr. Philip Tierno, who is the head of the NYU Medical Center, believes that from his work, and he's been studying toxic shock for 15 years, that viscous rayon, which is still in a lot of the tampons that are on the market, is attributable to the tampon acts as a catalyst if it has viscous rayon on it for toxic shock. And
so maybe we can just explain a bit for the listening audience what exactly toxic shock is.
Well, it's a disease that is caused by a staph in your system, which is a natural staph, which is called Staphylococcus aureus. And sometimes it's in your nose, and sometimes it's in your ears, and it moves around. And if it's in your vagina when you have a tampon in it, if it's in your vagina and when you're menstruating, it's fine. It just, it's a natural thing to have. But if you put a tampon in during that time and you happen to have Staphylococcus aureus, or the strain of it, what happens is it acts as a catalyst, and the tampon, the staph will breed in the tampon. And what you do is you toxify yourself. So a lot of women are getting, I've talked to a lot of women that have lost fingers, have lost legs. You can get large, your organs, there's problems with a lot of the liver, kidney.
Leading to possible organ death.
Yeah, and death is, the woman that we interviewed lost, and she's in the film, lost both her legs, and the tips, or half of three or four of her fingers, and nearly died. I mean, she was in critical condition for a long time. She is just an incredible fighter. The stories that she has are just unbelievable, of her fight back from that disease. I mean, it's extremely painful disease, and the symptoms are very much like flu. When you first get, when you get it, it's a lot like flu. So you don't know, if you're not aware of that, and you don't know the first thing to do is to remove the tampon, then I think that's where things need to change. I think women need to know what are the symptoms and to just take it out, you know. I don't wear them anymore myself, personally, and after my research, you know. I'm not a tampon user anymore.
and one of the problems is that the time is not necessarily a determinant. You could, I think, have the tampon in for a short period of time and contract, colonize enough bacteria that you might have developed toxic shock syndrome.
Well, yeah, I think the time thing is it's always up for debate.
Okay.
So I couldn't really say either way on that, but the overnight, you know, to wear it overnight, Dr. Tierno says is not a cool thing to do. I mean, these are the viscous rayon, the
okay.
ones that have cotton and viscous rayon. I mean, they used to have the Rely tampon had polyester in it, it had polyacrylate in it, it had super absorbent fibers, you know, and the reason that, from my perspective, that the product companies wanted to moved away from the cotton tampon is because of it would leak. You know, it would fill up with blood and it would leak, and women didn't want to have stains, you know, and leakage, because that's a drag, you know. So what they did is they tried to create a product that would not leak, and that makes perfect sense. But what he's saying is that, well, yeah, but if the product changes the chemical balance within that whole system, then that's a problem, you know.
Yeah. And now back on the market are some actual all-cotton tampons, or supposedly all-cotton tampons.
Yeah, there was a another person that we interviewed in the film was a lawyer by the name of Robert Perkins and Mark Hutton. And what they did is they filed a class action suit against two of the product companies looking at for toxic shock victims, you know, people who... They wanted all, there's a lot of women who, their claims weren't big enough. They might have just been in the hospital overnight. They had, you know, they might have been lost just, you know, a finger, or, you know, it wasn't like a significant, I mean, my finger would be significant, but, you know, there were cases that were big enough for them to actually take on, to do all the legal work that they would have to do. So for the smaller cases, what they wanted to do is they wanted to have a, file a class action suit, which they did, and they didn't get due to jurisdiction. I mean, to put together, the laws were so different between all the states. This was in the United States. But they suggested that the reason that the all-cotton tampon, which is out now, came back onto the market, you know, that their class action case was instrumental in that. The companies deny that, of course, from what I've heard. But there was another company, which is a smaller company called NatraCare, which was started by Susie Houston in Britain, which developed the all cotton, brought the all cotton tampon back. And right now, they are claiming, NatraCare is claiming that Tambrand's new Naturals tampon is not all cotton.
And Tambrand's is Tampax?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Tambrand's is Tampax. So, and of course, that's being denied. So
we don't know.
We don't know at this point. Yeah, what the upshot of that's going to be? That's happening right now.
So we would think for NatraCare to bring sort of allegations, would there have done some research and of the composition of the?
Well, apparently it's with the overwrap, which is put on a tampon, and they're claiming that that's not all cotton. So we'll see what happens with that. I don't know. But that's the thing about working in this area is I was just flooded with information looking at the environmental impact of, like, for instance, the plastic applicator. We had a guy in the film who was championing what's happening with the sea life and fish with regard to what they were calling the New Jersey beach whistles. You know,
yep.
Got all these plastic applicators that are really causing a lot of havoc. And
yeah, women are just flushing them down the toilet, even though, doesn't it say don't flush?
Well, I think...
But even if they arrive in landfill,
yeah, and there's
still,
actually, there's there are actually a lot of... what the environmentalists, the Women's Environmental Network in the UK found is that... and then here, WEED in Toronto... was that women were actually flushing full pads down. And the plastic liners are going out into the ocean as well. Like, the back liner on the pad is also heading out into the ocean. So we went to a sanitary... we went to a sewage treatment plant and looked at how many applicators and pads were coming through the system. And then they have these big screens, these big grids to try and stop them. Like, there's this huge... The other thing that's in there, which was interesting, was condoms and Q-tips by the millions. I've never seen so many Q-tips. Just like the sticks. It was just unbelievable.
Here's an interesting story for you. I was reading in Terminal City the other day that they had found a 60-foot deep and approximately 4-mile long reef of condoms floating in the South Pacific.
Wow.
And now I guess because they have this latex, is this sort of latex likes latex, so they've all joined together, and with the currents,
wow,
you know, they've bonded.
Incredible.
Frightening. So maybe there's the same reef of tampons floating around.
Well, the average woman throws away 250 to 300 pounds of tampons, pads, and applicators in her lifetime.
And that's pretty. And what, you know, it's interesting because you have all these companies that are they're making a lot of profit off of women, but it's there's not enough companies out there, or maybe the issues aren't out there, or what women can have as alternates. What they can choose to
do. And I think choice was the big thing that we found. It's like, well, you know, you don't, you know, a lot of people said, well, you can't blame women for, you know, because it's a necessity, and what the hell else are we supposed to do, you know?
Well, a lot of women, like maybe not the West Coast, there's tends to be more, perhaps more availability of a choice here, but elsewhere, I'm not sure.
Well, you know, there's the pad that you can the washable pad now. A lot of pad companies have come out and doing the washable pad, and you know, I guess it comes back to a convenience thing. Like, our bathrooms aren't set up so that you can actually like wash your pad and do that in the sink. You know, it's just like you got those little containers to throw away. Like, we don't have a system in place for any really major alternatives. So I have tried the washable pads, and I wear them when I'm at home. But you know, when I'm out at, you know, like
traveling,
traveling board meeting or something, it's
kind of you might be worried about how long of time, and are you going to be away from home for a long time, and where are you going to soak them, and
Because you've got to do there's a whole little
ritual
that goes on with it, yeah. But a lot of women are saying that, kind of gotten into that and saying, okay, but I actually know how much I bleed now. I never knew that before with a tampon. I know my cycle, you know.
You probably do a lot more, yeah.
One of the other interesting people in our film is a biologist by the name of Margie Proffitt. She got the MacArthur Genius Award for her work, which is incredible. What she found in her work is she looked at why we bleed at all. Like, she asked that question, because she said, I just didn't really get it. Like, is it because we're like inferior to men, and this is something like, why do we have all this waste? Why would our body, it takes an enormous amount of energy to slough off your walls of your lining and bleed every month. Why is that? And what she came up with through her research was that there's a whole reservoir of organisms that live on the vagina. And when a woman has sex, when the penis goes through that area and ejaculates, what happens is the sperm actually has the germs or organisms actually ride on the coattails of the sperm the next, and you've got possible situation for infection within the womb. So what menstruation does is actually fights against that by actually taking all the organisms that have come in through the sperm and through sexual intercourse, and that are all sitting on the vagina wall or the wall, and it sloughs off, and that's the reason. It's to actually protect the uterus from infection. And that made just so much sense to me. I mean, that to me was just, okay, yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, because otherwise it's like, well, is it just because, well, I didn't have a baby, so that egg's just going to disintegrate and, you know, is this a loss every month or is there another? It is a loss every month, I assume, for a lot of women. And I guess that's a bit of a tangent, but I think in our lives that your period means something different to you at every stage. Like when you're a young girl, it's like, I want to get it. Oh my God, here it is. I'm excited. And then when you're in your teens and you're experimenting at, you know, 20 or whatever, oh my God, I don't have it. I'm pregnant. Oh my God, I don't have it. You're waiting for it. So you're not pregnant. Then when you get into your age, when you decide you want to have children, when you get it, you're upset. Oh, it's here. It's a look, because it means that you're not pregnant and you want to be pregnant. You know, it's just like it's a constant in your life, but your attitude, I think, towards it changes all the time, you know?
Yeah, I remember a film that was also showcased. It was about women who were sort of happy, it seemed, that they were not going to have to experience menstruation anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, I think women, when they do approach menopause, it brings a whole bunch of other symptoms, the hot flashes and whatnot, And I think that there is a sense of loss too. You're no longer fertile, or you're no longer you're...
Oh yeah, menopause is a whole other thing. Like mm-hmm. one woman we met with said, "Well, if getting your period is becoming a woman, what is not having it anymore? What am I become then?" You know?
Yeah.
You know.
True enough.
What is that saying?
Yeah, it's our identifier, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of women. Well.
So, you know, I hope people will tune in and have a look. And it was a really enjoyable film to do. I mean, I learned a tremendous amount from all the people. Like, we went to the Museum of Menstruation as well. Just
fascinating.
Fascinating. Judy Blume is in the film. She reads from "Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret," and some of the letters she's received from the young women who have written to her, afraid about going into the bathroom and actually someone seeing them buy a tampon. I think there's hopefully a lot of food for thought in there. And people can make up their own minds, of course. And I always feel the film, whenever you do one, all you can do is raise questions. You know, you can never provide answers. That's not your job. Your job is just to raise some discussion around a subject. And Teresa and I, this is we're just starting our fourth film together. So she did two films before I hooked up with her, but this is our fourth one down the road now we're just doing. So they're always, you just always learn an incredible amount from the people that you're privileged to go and spend time with, you know.
And you have a lot of interesting sources, I think, credits or sources of information at the tail end of the film. So for women who want more knowledge, even it's like sort of like the history of menstruation, which is something you didn't really cover, but
mm-hmm.
I think that's in Blood, Bread, and Roses.
Yes, the author is Judy Gron, and she's fabulous. She has done a 15 or 20 years of work on the history of menstruation, and her book, if anyone... has the gumption to go out and raise the money for it. I mean, something should be done on that subject. We just couldn't cover everything in our time. And she's absolutely fabulous.
Fabulous. And yeah. You don't plan to delve further into this area right now? You're off into do other stuff?
Not at this point. I was very tempted to do, we were very tempted to do an educational film for the schools as well. And I'd like to go back and do that at some point. I just wanted to say how you can buy the film if you want to. It's being distributed by the National Film Board of Canada. And the toll-free number is 1-800-267-7710, which is 1-800-267-7710. And, you know, we had tremendous support. Whenever you're raising money for a film, we had the National Film Board of Canada came in on the project. We had Knowledge Network, TV Ontario, Saskatchewan Communication Network, Fan City came in, British Columbia Film, and the National Film Board of Canada. So it's Vision Television.